Hello there, this is Samuel Gilbert. Today I'm speaking with the co-founder and the CEO of CurryFirst, potentially one of the biggest gaming publishers on the continent in Africa, Mr. Cordell Robin Cooker. CurryFirst raised about $20 million earlier this year from the likes of Andreessen Horowitz, Google, Mr. Rapper himself, Mr. Nas, Avenir. It's an interesting list of investors who came on board for an African gaming publishing company. So we shall talk about what life has been like since they raised that amount of money, what opportunities they see in the continent, as well as some big projects that they have rolled out with very early success already. This is going to be one of three conversations I'm going to have about the gaming space in Africa. So without further ado, let's get into it.
So the last time we talked was when I guess, you know, the whole world was very excited. And I think the one part that stood out for me was how you were excited about having Nas as one of the investors in your raise. Right, remember?
Yes.
Could you just talk to me about what the kind of life and business has been like since then, since the big raise? That was back in what, January?
In January of this year, yeah.
Yeah, what have you guys been up to? What have you been doing with the money? Tell me what it's been like.
It's been a whirlwind, I would say. We announced in January, and there was a ton of excitement and enthusiasm about the raise. I think even we were a little bit surprised about how much people cared. And so, you know, having A16Z make their first investment in a company headquartered in on the continent, having Google in there, having Nas, it really gave us like a big boost. And so the awesome thing is, I think from a like business development standpoint, from a partner standpoint, and even recruiting, the fundraise helped us a lot before we even started deploying capital. I would say, you know, beyond that, we've been really focused on growing the business. So, you know, our business is split between publishing games, where we license them from third parties and we also develop them. And then growing our fintech platform where we sell virtual content with using local payment methods. And so, you know, we've spent most of the time really kind of growing the team. We've almost doubled the team. We're at like 55 people now in over 20 countries around the world. We've been adding products and we've been scaling. So our revenues have increased by about 5x from the end of last year. And so there are good things associated with that, but there are also a lot of challenges with scaling. Things break and there are lots of fires to put out. So it's been exciting.
I mean, that does sound amazing. Like that's a very fast growth as well. Can you give us what the 5x is in absolute values?
We're not sharing that. Okay.
Oh, just like a ballpark picture. So we have in the billions, in the millions, is it like, what are we, tens of millions? What are we talking about?
Definitely in the millions, in the high teens, millions right now.
Okay. So like one thing that wasn't very clear for me when we first talked, was what, you know, the different parts of the ecosystem that you're in. And it's not just game publishing. You are becoming like a payment platform because you have your store, you're in the NFT space, and like, you know, you're using crypto. And that is on top of the solid product that you have, which is publishing games. I think I just saw the other day that one of the games that are published through you was top one in like the president made it to the top of the list. So it's kind of like really, you know, big things are happening on a global space. Can we just start with the publishing aspect of the business and tell me what the problem was, you know, what opportunities there were in Africa and why Africa was a, you know, a good place to start this from? And then kind of like, let's go and see how quickly you've been able to kind of like have those checks on the Play Store.
100%. So on the publishing side, there were, I would say, two big problems. One is for international content owners, whether studios or publishers, they've had a really hard time scaling and making money in Africa. And the core reason that we found is because, one, distribution and marketing and really tailoring the messaging to users on the continent takes a little bit of time and focus and local know-how, and people hadn't really applied that focus yet. But the bigger issue, the reason why they haven't applied focus, is that it's been tough to monetize. And so, you know, on the continent, fewer than 10% of people have an internationally accepted credit card, and that's basically the currency of global content. And so on that side of the house, when it comes to international content, we act as a one-stop shop, whereby a partner doesn't have to dedicate specific resources to Africa, to understanding the difference between, you know, Hausa and Yoruba, or the difference between, you know, colloquial approaches in Nigeria versus Kenya. We basically act as their go-to-market partner, and we simplify all of that complexity for them. And then obviously on the payment side, which we can talk a little bit more about, we allow folks on the continent to be able to pay for international content using methods that are available to them, like mobile money, like local bank transfer, like local random card schemes that people have never heard of. And so, you know, we the first piece is helping international content scale in the region where there's a massive opportunity, you know, 1.4 billion people and amazing demographics and tons of growth. The other side, which when you talk about the president, is local game developers in Africa haven't really yet broken out and had international success. And I would say the president and Mikan Games is the first. And it happened with like extraordinary success, right? So we launched an incubator late last year called Crazy Hubs, in partnership with one of the biggest publishers in the world, which is called Crazy Labs. They have over 4 billion downloads in their history. So pretty awesome company. And the idea was, could we work with local game developers on the continent who had, you know, talent, who had aspirations to do this for a living, but had never really made any money or had commercial success? Could we bring them to one place? Carry First would host them, and then Crazy Labs would provide them with training and guidance as to how to make commercially successful hyper-casual games. And so we ran our first cohort in November for 4 months, you know, 20 members. We fed, clothed, housed them for 4 months, and tried to teach them how to make games. And you know, it's really, really, really tough to make a commercially successful game. And I think it's amazing that in our first cohort, we had a team from Kenya that had a game that not only became successful, but became the number one downloaded game in the United States, which is the biggest, most competitive, most like badass market that exists. The idea that a couple guys from Nairobi would be crushing it in the States after graduating from our incubator is amazing. So we're super excited about that. We want to continue that program. And I would say, honestly, it was unexpected, but it just shows what kind of latent talent is here that just isn't being tapped.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing that I guess is clear across board, not just in the gaming space, but across board, is there's a lot of talent on the continent. And anybody who's able to be that connector, or in your case, be a publisher of, you know, bringing in these guys who can make games and get them to the market, that is such a niche and needed service that you're providing in the gaming space that, you know, I keep seeing in other payments or education or whatever it is, spaces as well. Is that a good read of I have of like, you know, like what you're trying to do, like take this talent that we have on the continent and, you know, value add more or less, right?
Yeah, it is. That's part of our value proposition. I think you said it well. We're looking to be the bridge between Africa and the world. And it goes in two directions. I think folks on the continent want to engage with the best games and the best media in the world. And so we help people essentially, you know, get that content into their hands. But on the other side, as you mentioned, there is so much talent on the continent that is untapped. And we do try and be a bridge in the other direction, sort of connecting local developers on a global basis. Now, you know, originally as a pure play publisher, something like Crazy Hubs would never be in your remit, because what you typically will do is you go find folks who either have a great game or are very close to having a great game. And what you provide is potentially some capital to help them finish it, a little bit of guidance as far as, you know, what you think will work in the market. And then ultimately you're the business arm, right? You're acquiring users, you're live operating the game, you're monetizing. And so we have a partnership like that on the continent with a studio called Kenne Games. But what we found was there aren't many Kenne Games on the continent. So you don't have thousands and thousands of kind of ready-made professional studios where you can just go to them and say, give me your game, I'll go and I'll publish it for you. And so something like Crazy Hubs is actually helping to cultivate, to develop the talent pool so that there will be in 6 months, a year, 5 years, a big, vibrant, professional studio ecosystem in Africa. There's a big difference between making a game that's fun and making a game that makes money, right? A game that's fun is a toy, and a game that's fun and retentive and people are willing to either spend or watch ads to play, that's an enterprise. And enterprises, I think, is what we need for folks moving forward.
Nice. That is very interesting. And you bring up a few things that raised a few questions on me for me. And one is like kind of the first question I asked you about, like, your revenues. But what kind of models do you have when you are thinking about, you know, who to bring into your next cohort or who to partner with? What kind of games are you thinking? I mean, I'm assuming it's a lot of mobile games now that makes sense for, especially at least for the kind of world we're in. Or are you also doing console games or PC games? So in that space, as well as what kind of a relationship do you have with, you know, when you bring in a cohort to come and train with you and go ahead and, you know, build a game that becomes financially profitable, what kind of deals that do you make with the different partners that you work with?
Yeah, our focus today is almost 100% mobile. It's the fastest growing and now the largest part of the ecosystem, even on a global basis. So it's about $100 billion industry out of a couple hundred billion dollar industry total. And importantly, mobile democratizes access to games. right? You don't have to buy a console, which costs $800 or $900. You don't have to buy a gaming PC, which costs a few thousand dollars. You can use something which you already had in your pocket, which you were going to have anyway, so that you can, you know, chat with your friends and go on dating apps. And you can access games which are free to play. And so it took gaming from something which was almost entirely Western, upper middle class, oftentimes male dominated, and just like democratized it. So now, you know, mobile games are equally distributed, male, female, actually slightly skewed towards female.
Yeah,
that's one thing that surprises people. The majority of mobile gamers and payers are female. It's evenly distributed across age groups. So I used to say when I was pitching that the median mobile gamer is a 40-year-old woman, right? Which would surprise people because they're thinking about, you know, a sweaty 17-year-old in like his parents' basement playing games all day. So mobile has like fully democratized gaming. And the big thing for us is it makes it accessible in frontier markets like Africa, whereby the barrier to sort of access is much lower. So that's the main reason why we're focused on mobile. There's a little bit of an opportunity, we believe, when it comes to publishing, helping with community payments, and just activation around PC and console games. So there are some international partners that we are speaking with and potentially will work with to help them with community on the continent. But I would say mobile is the primary means, is sort of our primary channel today. And then when you think about commercial arrangements, the thing that I love about the gaming industry and the way it's developed is it tends to be kind of win-win partnerships. And so the way we tend to look at things is on a what we call revenue share, but actually is closer to like a profit share. And so it varies depending on who the partners are and what the game is and what the markets are. But the idea is if a game makes more money, we all make more money. And if it makes less, we all make less. So we're all incentivized to build awesome games, to acquire as many users as possible, and to give them as good an experience so that they're willing to spend money or watch ads.
Interesting. I mean, this is partly a lot of like new like frontier knowledge for me as well. So it's that if I'm asking you questions that are very basic, think bring that out. I had in terms of the size of the market itself. I think you put up a report some point last year that Africa was a like. I'll let you tell me the figures, but how big is the market when it comes to the value, and then in terms of numbers of developers that are working on games, specifically mobile games on the continent, what are, you know, what's the size of that? And then kind of like the president was huge in the US, but what are the other markets? Is there a huge market in Europe for the same games in Asia? Are we able to penetrate Chinese games as well? How is that looking like?
Yeah. So when you think about the market for game developers on the continent, it's actually currently there really is no official data. But I would say it's really, really small. I would estimate there are probably fewer than 100 studios that are making games for a living on the continent. And the reason why I believe is because you just don't have many examples of folks who have done it successfully, like the president with Mekan Games and made money and that kind of thing. And so if you don't have any examples of folks that are doing it commercially, you don't tend to get the best developers necessarily that are focused. So we have tons of brilliant engineers, artists, animators, but my guess is they're all working for fintech companies right now. And only the people who are like obsessed with games are like, you know, I'm going to quit my job and make games for a living. Now, making games for a living is a great like endeavor. And I think that will change over time as people see examples like the president and say, okay, not only is this something that I love and that's fun, but I can actually make money doing it and build a business and make a life for myself and my family. So I would posit that there are fewer than 100 like commercial studios on the continent. When it comes to the consumer market, the official data, which we put out last year with Newzoo, says that we've cleared over 300 million gamers, and that we cleared just over $1 billion of total revenues in the industry. My sense is that the revenue
global numbers are.
Oh no no, that's in Africa.
So 300 million in Africa.
Gamers in Africa, yeah.
Okay. Including mobile games, okay.
Exactly. So those are unique gamers. So number of folks who are playing games. It's actually just about 300 total. And so that's a big market when you think about it. There are only, you know, 300 million people in the United States total. Right. And as mobile penetration continues to increase and as people make games and market to users on the continent, you know, this could be very easily a 600 or 700 million gamer economy or market. Typically, 2/3 of smartphone users are playing games, right? Mm. So if you think at some point there will be nearly 100% smartphone penetration, and those figures hold up, we'll have 1 billion gamers on the continent, right? Like it's not infeasible. And the revenues, interestingly, grew over 7x in a 10-year period. And I honestly think that they're probably understated. What I find when I travel, like we were just in Lagos with our team a few weeks ago, is that there are a lot of people that are finding workarounds to try and pay for content. They're VPNing to a different country and getting a USD card so that they can buy, you know, a PlayStation subscription. They're importing, you know, PS5s from Dubai and then selling them locally. There's a huge gray market, I believe, whereby folks are finding workarounds to be able to play the games, engage with the content that they want, and get around just sort of the restrictions that exist in our ecosystem. So, you know, 1 billion is the official number, and I think it's probably much larger.
Speaking of how creative people are on the continent, someone was telling us how they would use their cards to sign up for, say, YouTube Premium for a month just to get the free access or the 3-month free access, and then just, you know, cancel the card because the card costs less than the subscription itself, and then repeat and rinse. And that, I guess, is a good transition into the other conversation of payments that you're also working on, and the crypto space and the Web3 product that you are integrating, because I guess it's an obvious transition when you talk about gaming and the metaverse. It seems like where we're headed. Can you just also talk to me about what you're thinking about in that space and what you're actually doing right now?
Absolutely. So we have a e-commerce website, which basically sells virtual goods. The concept is called a top-up shop. We, you know, borrowed it from Southeast Asia and China. And it's a place where people can go and buy digital content using a wide range of payment methods. And so our shop, which is called the Carry First Shop, it has things from what we call like basic utilities, which would be airtime, data, prepaid electricity, to entertainment products. We have a direct integration with Tinder, for example. So you can top up, you know, your dating app subscriptions. And then finally, and most importantly, we have a really wide range of in-game content. And so what it allows for is people who maybe aren't able to make an in-app purchase because they don't have a relevant payment method or whatever other reason, to be able to make a purchase of in-game items, whether it's through a voucher or an automatic top-up, and basically get back to playing games. So very simply, we have a digital marketplace which allows people to use local payment methods to buy whatever they want. And our view is that, you know, today that may be a relatively small share of a user's wallet, but that it's definitely growing, and that over time it will be the sort of dominant means. As more of your time and your social life and your entertainment moves online, you're going to spend more and more of your money on digital and virtual items as opposed to, you know, physical items, t-shirts, and, you know, whatever else you purchase on a traditional e-commerce website. So that's a carry first shop. And underlying that is a payments aggregation engine, which we've built, where we're integrated with now over 20 different gateways that opens up over 90 different payment methods for users across Africa. And one of the things that we thought about is, well, look, if we're enabling things like mobile money or local bank transfer or agents, why not enable crypto at point of sale, right? Users on the continent are already adopting crypto at higher rates than almost anywhere in the world. There's a report which says that 5 of the top 20 countries in the world with regard to peer-to-peer crypto payments are in Africa. And so people on the continent are adopting Web3 to handle like traditional legitimate use cases in their life beyond like speculation and hoping that like Bitcoin triples in price. And so, you know, we want to make that available and accessible for our users when it comes to, you know, buying digital content as well. So we're integrated with partners that allow us to accept crypto at point of sale. And we're, you know, very, very bullish on the space.
I mean, one thing that comes up whenever we talk about especially payments and crypto specifically is the question of regulation. Many regulators on the continent, obviously, are trying to keep all the dollars within their borders, so they do not want you to be having, to some extent, this cross-border payment systems, especially in crypto. So how are you dealing with that question of regulation? Do you have to deal with the different country-based regulators, or the fact that you have a partnership with someone else already has that kind of takes you away from that conversation? But also on the shop itself, is it just you who's creating the content and selling it, or are you also like allowing a peer-to-peer kind of trading to occur on your system?
With regard to regulation, our general approach is to stay as far away from regulated industries, regulated products, and regulators, broadly speaking, for a number of reasons, but mainly because we want to focus on consumers and figuring out how to solve their problems. So when it comes to payment partnerships, we tend to work through a gateway or an underlying service provider that takes care of that heavy lifting for us and maintains compliance. So our general approach is stay away and stay close to the consumer when it comes to that, as opposed to regulators.
So who are Who are some of the gateways that you're working with in the different markets?
Yeah, so there some of your regional folks that you would have heard of, your Paystacks and Flutterwaves and Cellulants of the world, some international ones. We have a direct integration with MasterCard Payment Gateway Services, PayPal, and the list goes on. So our idea is really to not duplicate the good work and the hard work that all of these payment service providers have done, integrating directly with telcos and banks and doing a lot of work with security and regulation, but just to work with them and be basically like a super merchant. So our, again, like we want to be in situations where everyone wins. Our consumers get access to products they want. Our payment providers get more transactions and more flows and more fees. And ultimately, we grow the market and take our share of the pie.
Mm, okay. And then on the market, the peer-to-peer potential market?
Today, it's only sort of us providing products. There's a little bit, there's a two-sided element to it, because we've just started allowing third-party games to list their products directly in our shop. And so, you know, historically, we would only list games where we're directly licensing the game. You know, we're the go-to-market arm in Africa. But we realized that, you know, when we spoke to a lot of different studios, they would say, you know, I'm not sure if we're ready to publish in Africa, but can we use your payments platform? Mm. Right? They'd say, like, you know, we have all these users that are showing up. We have this, all these daily active users, but they're not monetizing. Can we, you know, could we just use your payments or use your shop? And we'd be like, no, 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 we're a publisher. We want, you know, we want it all. and at some point we realized that, you know, you kind of have to push them the way they lean, if that makes sense. And if the current approach is people want to take a first step, which is to prove to themselves that folks on the continent are willing to pay for their in-game items and pay for their content, that we should do that. So it is, you know, it's two-sided in that there's third-party content, but it's not peer-to-peer yet.
Okay. How many games do you have published already, and what are you able to kind of forecast what we may expect, say, in the next 2, 3 years, 5 years?
That's a good question on the forecast. So our publishing approach is, I would say, narrow and deep. So each partnership that we work with is, you know, there's a technical element. We do a lot of work on the game, and we pour usually a lot of dollars into user acquisition to grow the game and try and drive as much revenues as possible. So my view is that at peak, you know, when we're a $100 billion company, we would have no more than 10 to 12 active games at any one point in time. Now, we will probably have tested hundreds and, you know, released dozens. But the idea is to have a few really high quality games which cover all the demographics, you know, young folks, older folks, competitive gamers, more casual gamers, and really grow those franchises. So today we have 3 games live. We have 7 licensed, which are at various stages of soft launch. And I would project that we'd release another maybe 3 to 4 games next year. The one interesting thing is we've just started developing our own games again. That's how the company started in the very early days. We expanded to a third-party publishing model. And now we're getting started in game development again. So that may add some more titles to the portfolio.
Why do you decide to go back to the original plan?
Well, I would say it's supplementing. The reason why is we in testing hundreds and hundreds of games, we realize that there's a gap in the market, that there, I would say, AAA game developers or Western game developers are building games which are really, really well suited to Western audiences, and particularly from a technical standpoint, games that work on very high-end smartphones with tons of storage and tons of processing capacity, and that actually a lot of users in our region kind of physically, technically cannot enjoy those games, right? They're using a lower end smartphone. They have intermittent connectivity. You know, a lot of people play games on their commute. If you think about the commute, you know, in and out of Nairobi or across Third Mainland Bridge in Lagos, you might be on a 4G connection, then a 3, then you might have no connection, and then it might pop back, but you only have 2G, right? And if you're trying to play a game that requires like pristine connectivity, where you know, a few milliseconds of latency or delay will cause you to lose, you know, you just can't really enjoy those games. And so we're building games that are fun to play, but that are going to be a lot more accessible for folks in frontier markets. That's the idea.
I mean, I'm thinking you are an African-based publisher or all-encompassing gaming company, but you're not just an African company, right? It is a global company because you're going to try and market to the US and have whatever it is, Asia and everybody else. So how does your presence being in Africa give you a competitive advantage to top that market? Also, you know, what disadvantages does it come with? I'm thinking this because of other conversations I've had with other like fintech-based companies that have African developers who are relatively cheaper, mm-hmm. but of the same quality, or if not even better sometimes in Nigeria, and they're able to do the jobs that anybody can do.
I think being headquartered on the continent provides some benefits. I think from a talent standpoint, we do have, I would say, differential access to talent. We're a fully remote company. So mm-hmm. we have folks in over 20 different countries, including, you know, parts of Europe and the US. And so it allows us to recruit, you know, the best and brightest from wherever they are. But we do have, I would say, deep insights and networks in places like Lagos, like Nairobi, like Cape Town, where you do have young folks who are incredibly talented, who might not have access to a global job market. And so, or you have access to folks maybe in the diaspora who are from the continent, but left. Excuse me.
Okay.
At least it's not live recording.
You okay?
Yeah. Let me just grab some water.
Quick. Okay.
All right. Sorry about that.
I don't know how to edit, so I can't take that out.
Pardon?
I'm just playing. Are you okay though?
Yeah, I just got a cough.
Okay. What were we saying?
What were we talking about?
on that, yeah, being Africa headquartered, but you have, you know, you're a remote
reach.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, people of African descent who might be living in the US or Europe have some tie back and maybe a desire to be impactful in the region or to serve users on the continent, but haven't had the opportunity to. because, you know, they ultimately took the opportunity to go and maybe study at a great school in the US, or, you know, get their first job at a major tech company. So we really feel like we have the ability to recruit from anywhere across the globe. So talent is one thing where we feel like we have an advantage, but the other benefit is just having a, having like a home court advantage. There is a region where we know more than anyone else. We have more relationships and we have sort of differential expertise. And so, you know, we feel like there's a massive benefit to that. And some of the biggest and most powerful gaming companies in the world pivot on that, right? If you look at Tencent, if you look at Sea, they are able to kind of dominate their home base and then, you know, compete on a global basis. And so that's what we hope we'll be able to do.
Yeah. I mean, and again, at this point, you have more or less put the continent on the map when it comes to game publishing. Obviously, there are other smaller players on the continent who will benefit, I guess, from your at least name being out there. I don't want to call it dominance. So it's a, at least the social proof has already happened. And now it's a matter of, I guess, maturing and see how that goes into the future. I think I asked about the metaverse since, you know, usually the porn industry and the gaming industry are always at the cutting edge of these things.
Yes.
And yet you have to be one of those two. So what are you doing? What are you experimenting with in that space? Not just, you know, making skins for games, but are you doing anything more than that? Or what should we expect from any of the things you publish?
Yeah, so I think there's a really important nomenclature distinction to make. I think there are, I would say, two very hot streams of gaming right now. One is crypto gaming, play to earn, play and earn. And the other is what people have termed kind of the metaverse broadly defined. They're related but distinct, right? So crypto and Web3 allows for genuine ownership of digital assets. So, you know, in a game, if you buy a skin or earn currency, you actually own it. You can transfer it to someone else on a blockchain. You can sell it and make money. You can save it and give it to your kids, you know, when you die or whatever. And I think that will help enable the metaverse, right? But the metaverse is slightly different, or it's very different, right? The metaverse is essentially a fully immersive, persistent, like spatial reality in a digital world. And so I would say today, we're not particularly active in thinking about things with regard to the metaverse. Typically, it requires pretty high-end equipment, AR, VR equipment, requires like a ton of infrastructure when it comes to connectivity and real-time communications. And so our view is that I think the West will probably lead on that for a while. And at some point when it's been cracked, and then people start thinking about, well, how do we make the metaverse more accessible or more sustainable or, you know, whatever, then I think it will be interesting for us and folks across the global South. Now, Web3 gaming is actually in many ways the opposite. I think Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America are actually tier one markets when it comes to Web3 gaming, because fundamentally what it allows is for folks who have more time, intelligence, ingenuity, and energy than money to be able to actually leverage all of their skills and their energy and to earn and own assets that have real value. So play to earn or play and earn gaming, to the extent it takes off, I think is gonna really have its home base in the global South, in frontier markets. And if you've seen the examples that have taken off, they've tended to take off in places like Southeast Asia. And so we're pretty excited about it. Again, we're a publisher primarily. And so we start with, you know, can we find awesome content? And then what do we do with it? And I think the industry is still somewhere in the process of making awesome content that has Web3 associated with it. And as that develops, we're going to be right there helping to publish it in the region. We're working on some things in the like payments and commerce space that's related to Web3 games that we think will help folks be able to on-ramp and engage those games. But ultimately, people have to make great Web3 games, right? Just because it's has crypto in it doesn't mean it's going to be fun. Games have to engage people for a long time. And games are entirely discretionary. That's like the beautiful thing about it. If you get bored with a game, you'll just put it down, right? And so we have to start with fun first. And then I think there are tons and tons of positive implications with Web3 gaming for our users and a wide range of folks.
Yeah, I think you did answer that question when I asked you if you're doing mobile games, and you said 100%. And I guess, you know, we're not doing metaverse on your phone necessarily.
Not yet.
Not yet, at least. Yeah. Also on this, you know, the fun games that are coming out of potentially the continent, where are you, you know, looking and getting excited about some of the development that is coming from the African region? Who are making some of the fun games?
Look, it's still a small industry, I would say, there, and it's concentrated in a few centers for the most part. There's Nairobi. There's Lagos, there's a bit in Cape Town, and then you have a couple folks who pop up in you know, Ghana and Cameroon, etc. I would say, you know, some people that come to mind, obviously Mecan Games, the folks who made The President, are now off and running, and I see they're growing their team, and I imagine there's going to be some really awesome content that comes out of that team over time. Kenne Games in Ethiopia, I had mentioned before, you know, they have, I would say, produced multiple international quality games and are looking to continue to develop awesome content. And I have a lot of faith in them because I've worked with them very closely. And then there are a handful of other folks who I think have released some games that maybe haven't yet cracked the code, but that are talented and that are working on interesting ideas and concepts. So we're kind of constantly watching the space and trying to be helpful to the extent that we can be, and people want to work with us.
Nice. And you know, to anyone who doesn't know your background, can you just tell us like where in West Africa you were from, how you ended up in the US, and how you came back? Just generally a full circle story of Cordell's
mini bio. So I'm from Sierra Leone, which is a small, and I would say kind of hard luck country. I left in 92 during the kind of second year of a 10-year civil war and moved to the States. Lived in the States for 20 years, went to Stanford undergrad. I was very fortunate to have ended up there, having, you know, left essentially a war-torn country. So from the time that I became really aware of that in college, always had a dream of at some point kind of like deploying my skills and talent and good fortune back in the region. I started my career in investment banking. I spent 3 years with Morgan Stanley in New York and London. I then became a private equity investor with the Carlyle Group, worked closely with one of the founders for a couple of years in DC. And then they were launching an Africa focused fund and I raised my hand to join. So we raised about $700 million. I moved to Lagos, Nigeria in 2013. And I spent the next 5 years basically traveling all over the region, investing in companies across industries. That was amazing. Kind of like a reintroduction and a induction into life on the continent and business in different countries. I traveled all over. And while I was doing that, I started investing in tech startups on the side. Me and a Stanford buddy raised like a micro fund, about $1 million, and started cutting angel checks into African startups. And so that was what eventually...
What year was that?
We started in 2016, I want to say. So first two deals, so pre-fund, a couple deals that he had done. He had invested in Flutterwave and Andela. So it was that wave. And then the first couple deals that we did together were Paystack, which obviously got acquired by Stripe. And then a company called Max, which has gone on to do well and raise a couple rounds of financing. So in many ways, we kind of started at the perfect time. We hit like the golden age.
But how did you guys have that eye for like four out of four? Well, at least the ones you mentioned.
Well, I think part of it is just being on the ground. I was living in Lagos. He was in New York and well-connected. There weren't that many folks that were launching startups at the time. And so it was really, you got to see everything. If you were a funder and you can just tell, you know, smart guys who have gone to great schools, whether, you know, on the continent or internationally, working on a big problem. And, you know, it doesn't, there's a bit of luck and a bit of timing as well.
Can I actually ask on that? Because at least the three companies have gone kind of like in three different directions. Andela, you know, has become this global company. And then Paystack is at least now private. And then Flutterwave wants to do IPO, but is having drama right now. What do you make of that? Like, why do you think different things happen? I mean, I'm more interested in the Flutterwave now because it's the most current conversation in our space. But having seen it from the early days.
And it's a juicy story right now. Honestly, I think this is just very, very natural. If you were to ask me when I started my company, what would be the most ideal outcome, I would say, look, I would be happy to get acquired a few years later by a major, you know, international player from Asia. I would be happy to continue to raise venture capital and grow and you know, be a unicorn and see what happens. Or, you know, I would be happy to IPO in the NYSE or the NASDAQ and get liquidity and, you know, continue to run it. Like, you know, there are, when you start a company or when you invest in a company, there's a lot of different ways it can go. And there are different models of success, depending on how long you want to be doing it, depending on what your ceiling is as a company. And so I see those three examples and they don't raise an eyebrow for me, right? Like I've invested in so many companies professionally that, you know, you figure out what's right for you, what's right for your founders, and what's right for your investors. And so I would be happy with any of those outcomes as long as they're big.
Perfect. Last question, anything else you have to add? Or
nope, just nothing. Nope.
Okay. Right on time.
Awesome.
Thanks, Cordell.
Hopefully that was there's some interesting things in there.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Mr. Cordell. That was a very insightful and very wide-ranging conversation. And up next is going to be the maker of the game that went to the top of the charts in the US and is currently in international release. I shall be speaking with Mr. Ivan Skirago. So stay tuned.